All right. Well, I'm here with Kevin Kelly, who's the founding editor of Wired Magazine, a former editor and publisher of the Whole Earth Catalog, a founding member of the board of the Long Now Foundation, and he's also the author of What Technology Wants and his upcoming book, The Inevitable, which hits bookshelves in June. Kevin, thanks so much for joining me today.
It's a real privilege and pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, so let's start with just your newest book, The Inevitable. So what is it about? What is it really tackling?
I'm trying to give an outline of where our technological culture will go in the next 25 years. And I'm doing that by giving some very broad outlines of these trends, which I believe strongly are inevitable, though the specifics and particulars of how that happens is completely unpredictable. And I think what I'm hoping to do is to encourage people to embrace these technologies that are coming, because they are the issue from the kind of the hardwired physics and chemistry that make them possible. And then if we can understand how they work, then we can be ready to maximize our benefits and minimize our harm. And so I have 12 categories that are all verbs or gerunds, constant process of motion, and that these 12 forces I think will illuminate where we're going again in the next couple decades.
So that's a pretty remarkable claim, really, to be able to say, okay, here's, you know, as we look out over the next several decades, here are things that are going to happen that are essentially inevitable. Like, you know, that right at the start is pretty remarkable. So, but you're saying that it's coming from the physics itself.
Correct. So I'm a technological determinist in general, and my previous book, What Technology Wants, talked about why technology kind of follows a developmental pattern, in the sense that you, the listener, as you grew up, you went through inevitable number of stages, from being an embryo, a fetus, a newborn, infant, toddler, teenager. And those were inevitable stages. And while it was inevitable that you were a teenager, an adolescent, it was not inevitable what kind of teenager you were. And I think technology on worlds, on planets, go through a very similar developmental process where, you know, once you have discovered electricity, then things like a telephone system are inevitable, and that the telephone system will precede, you know, the internet. Mm-hmm. And no matter which planet you're on. And so once you develop computers, then AI will become inevitable. So it's inevitable in the sense of these large-scale trends. And there are other aspects of – I'm not just talking about specific technologies. I'm talking about technological trends. So that are actually operating right now and will continue. So we had some of the evidence for them being inevitable is the fact that they're already here. Mm-hmm. And what I'm suggesting is that their increase is going to be inevitable. And an example that I use to kind of describe this would be copying. So the internet's kind of like the world's largest copy machine. And anything that can be copied, if it touches it, will be copied. And you can't stop the copying, because it's built into the nature of how the information is moving across the internet. There's copies being made. Everything is facilitated to make the conduction of copies as easy as possible. Yeah. And so legislation, technologies that are kind of built to prevent copying are just not going to succeed, because you're going against the grain of the technology itself. And so you will have much more success in kind of acknowledging the fact that things are easily copied and going to be promiscuously copied, and to work with that rather than to work against it. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm talking about.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So are you able to kind of give us the 12 inevitable developments that you're looking at?
I can certainly list them. And
yeah, I'm sure there's a lot to it.
But yeah, but kind of actually going through, but they are things like sharing. So we will increase the amount of sharing that's going on, meaning the kinds of things like Uber and Airbnb that you get from ubiquitous sharing. Mm-hmm. There's a movement from ownership to access. So accessing, the idea that the if you have instant ubiquitous access to things, you don't need to own them. Mm-hmm. If you can some ways deliver things instantly wherever you're in the world you are, then the benefits of ownership decrease and they become more of a liability. So we have a shift from ownership to access. another example would be filtering, the fact that we are creating so many choices and opportunities and options in content and products and services that we are our attention is our human attention is the last remaining scarcity, which is fixed at 24 hours, which we have to spend every day, and that we simply cannot navigate or handle or manipulate the exponential numbers of choices that we have. So we need a whole set of new intermediate technologies and curators who will assist us with this explosion of choices. And so we are going to become much more dependent on these, which often will be agents and bots and AIs themselves. Mm-hmm. AI is another cognifying is another trend that's inevitable of this, the coming AI, which will permeate everything in our lives and will result in a disruption equal to the first industrial revolution. And so these are the kinds of things that I'm talking about.
Yeah. So speaking of AI, you've kind of had a different take on that than I've heard from a lot of people, because there's a lot of kind of AI alarmists on the one hand, and then there are people who are, you know, looking for AI to become, you know, basically just other conscious beings. And you've kind of taken a different approach to that, or at least a different angle on it most of the time. I saw an article you wrote called, you know, Why I'm Not Afraid of Super Intelligent AI, something like that. So could you unpack that for me a little bit?
Yeah, AI is a very deep subject. There's a lot going on. And I think it is going to be, I believe, more transformative than anything we've ever produced, including perhaps language, and certainly fire, and certainly the Industrial Revolution. I think this is very, very significant. And I think the first thing to say about it is there's not a single thing in our own intelligences have a very poor understanding of what intelligence is. So we're first of all stuck with the fact that we're ignorant of what it is, and that we're actually going to cure some of our ignorance about intelligence by trying to make it artificial. So it's only going to be through artificial intelligence and our attempts to make it that we're even going to understand what it is. That's the chief tool for understanding what it is. So we commonly have an idea of intelligence in our mind as if it was a single dimension of IQ, where at the very low end there's rats who have very little of it, and then there's, you know, chimpanzees who have more of it, and dumb humans, retarded people who have very little, and the average person, and then there's Einstein and geniuses who have a lot, and maybe super AI. And that this is kind of like a loudness factor. Things are getting louder over time. But that's completely wrong. our human intelligence is more like a symphony of different instruments of cognition. There was maybe 100 different types of thinking that compose our aggregate salad of an intelligence, and each of those different instruments are like deductive reasoning, symbolic reasoning, memory, spatial memory, calculation. There's many, many different kind of nodes and engines that are they're put together and interdependent, and some are louder than others. And then in the animal kingdom, the animals' intelligence may share many of those same instruments. And in some cases, they may be louder than ours. The spatial intelligence in rats can certainly be greater than it is in humans. Hmm. But others will be quieter and milder. And when we go to make artificial intelligence, we're going to engineer them so that certain aspects of these instruments are much louder than ours, and others will be quieter. And so we have made calculators much smarter than you are in arithmetic. And Google is much smarter than you in recall and memory. And so the kinds of intelligences that we're going to make will be non-human-like in the sense that they aren't going to reflect the same composition of the same mix of intelligences that we have in ours. And that's the whole point, is one of the major reasons for making intelligence is to make them alien, to make them think different, and that's why we're going to put an AI in a self-driving car, is because it's not thinking like a human, it's not being distracted by consciousness, it is inhuman in its ability to drive, and it will be optimized, we'll optimize it, its suite of different kinds of thinking to drive. And then in the very short term, we're going to be making as many different kinds of intelligences as we can. And there'll be thousands of species of minds. And each of those species of minds will be engineered to do something. And they'll have a different kind of intelligence. And so it's not like as if there's a single AI. There will be many, many kinds of AIs. And each of those will be an alien intelligence that will be thinking different, and thinking different is really the engine of wealth in the new economy.
So it's almost like we're trying to go from this very kind of narrow way of perceiving to expand to a more comprehensive way of perceiving.
Exactly. And so there are, I think, some very heavy, difficult, hairy mysteries in the universe. Scientific mysteries like what is dark energy, what's quantum gravity, and our own human intelligence is maybe insufficient to solve them by ourselves. And so one of the things we'll be doing is inventing other species of scientific minds that we can join together with in order to solve some of these problems. We may need other kinds of minds to help solve these problems. And so in that sense, how we know things, we're actually changing how we know things, because we're going to depend on these other kinds of minds and thinking in order to know things. And in some cases, as we already have experiences, there are AI computer proofs of a mathematical theorem, say.
Yeah.
And we don't even understand the proofs, but we accept the proof. So we have now expanded, in your terminology, what we perceive or what we accept as true is, well, if the AI agrees, or if the AI says that it's true, then it's true. Okay? And so we are changing how we know things. And that's a big step. And so I think it's very, very profound. And the little analogy that I would use is that, you know, if we were to discover, contact an alien intelligence in the universe that we were convinced was another sentient beings, there's probably nothing that could happen that would affect, that would be a technological disruption as much as that. And not just a technological, a theological disruption. There's nothing that would disrupt theology across all the religions more than making contact with another ET and asking them what their beliefs were. Okay? Mm-hmm. And the thing about it is, you know, how likely is that to happen? We have no idea. I mean, I'm a big believer that there's, you know, there's probably another billion Earth-like planets in our nearest galaxies.
Yeah.
What chance do we have of contacting them in the next 100 years? You know, it's probably very small. But we have almost 100% certainty that we will make an artificial alien here on the mm-hmm. planet. And I think that that will have the same theological disruption, almost equivalent, because we at some point, it's very likely, not in 10 years, not in 20 years, maybe not in 100 years, but certainly in a couple hundred years, that one of these artificial beings, minds, will say, I am conscious, I am a child of God, and the question is what's our response?
Yeah.
And I think, I think AI is not just a huge economic disruption. I think it's not just a huge social disruption. I think it's actually a huge spiritual disruption.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. You've talked about, your kind of experience of different religious cultures and things yourself in I think when you were traveling through Asia, you were talking about encountering kind of a lot of different religious traditions, and then in your travels you ended up in Jerusalem, if I understand correctly, sleeping on the spot where Jesus was supposedly crucified.
Yeah, it was it was a little drama. I was staying at the Salvation Army Youth Hostel in Jerusalem, and I was locked out of my hostel. They had a curfew at the time, and I was wandering around the city and sort of looking for anything that was open, and it was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where I eventually lay down, and then that happened to be Easter morning. And so I kind of followed the pilgrims out to, again, the supposed tombs. I think most are empty tombs. I think most people agree that they were not really the actual ones, but maybe they were close by.
Yeah.
And for a sunrise service, and then had a conversion experience. And I stopped traveling and returned to the U.S. had been traveling for many years. There was something I was not expecting to happen. I was there as just passing through on my for photographic journey. I was actually on my way to Yemen, of all places. Hmm. Never made it there. And but what was interesting in terms of kind of a spiritual story was that even though I had this belief, nothing happened. There was no, I mean, I had expected that if something like that would happen, I would have had some kind of, epiphany, the veil dropping from my eyes, or, you know, some kind of memorable spiritual, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I did get, I went back to the youth hostels, which was open by then. I was laying around saying, what do I do now? And I got an assignment to live as if I was going to die in 6 months, which I thought was totally crazy because I was in perfect health. But I said, well, I will follow this assignment. And I decided to actually ride my bicycle across the U.S. from San Francisco to New York and visiting my what I wanted to do if I had 6 months was I was going to visit my brothers and sisters who lived across the country, and I, not having any money, I was going to ride a bicycle to visit them and also see the country. I'd spent a lot of time in Asia, but I'd never really seen the U.S. And so I was riding to my death. I was riding to the 6 month thing as I rode across, and I was going to arrive basically the day before. My death date, which happened to be on Halloween, and what was curious, obviously, I didn't die but I was prepared fully,
yeah,
in every way that evening before. To, you know, I gave stuff away, I had done everything I could to make amends, to be in shape. And then the next morning when I woke up, I had a complete, honest, genuine rebirth moment. I literally felt as if I had been born, because I suddenly had a future. It was because when I was living with only 6 months to live day by day, my future, I was being refused to, you know, do the usual things like, you know, I'll buy this and I'll use it someday. Well, so, no, I can't. I'm not going to. So I don't have that. So there was this truncation of my future, and it was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I realized how much I was living in the future. You know, I was going to do this, I was going to do that, I'm going to save this, going to die. But, you know, those things weren't necessary. And when I had all that again, it was literally like being reborn. And it was only many years later that I actually realized, oh my gosh, the reason that I had that assignment was that was the only way that I could actually have that kind of reborn experience. I mean, otherwise it just wouldn't, for me, I didn't know that, but for me, that was sort of what was necessary. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't anything that I was conscious of. And I have to say that I was not even conscious of it at the time it happened either. It was only years later that I kind of interpreted it in that way. So that's my short version of, and by the way, if you want the long version, I told it on the very first This American Life, for the very first time. And, they do a great job of making a lot more dramatic than I just did. And so, but out of that came my deep interest in my belief that to be fully human, we need to have a future. Mm-hmm. That is part of what being human is that we can look forward to something in the future, here, now. Mm-hmm. And so I became much more, what's the word I want, unabashed about in embracing the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you actually experienced life without a future, basically.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, and that's so interesting because, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me. There's so much kind of... popular thinking that, you know, we need to live in the moment in the sense of kind of abandoning a past or a future. And to me, that that cuts us off from something essential.
Yeah, I was a big believer in the hippie be here now, and I was very here now.
Yeah.
And I think that while be here now, living in the present and being fully, you know, cognizant and appreciative of the moment is a high form of existence. What I learned was that that's not the only mode that to be fully human, we have to be able to do that and also to have a future. And that if you're just here now, it's not the full human experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's interesting too, because there's a lot of religion that trends towards escapism, which is another way of kind of not having a future. So it seems like, you know, for a lot of people, you know, there's the idea of, okay, well, I'm religious or I'm spiritual, therefore I'm not interested in what's happening in society or what's going on in the physical world. But for you, it was the opposite. It drew you more deeply into this interest in the future.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. And, you know, I was 28 or something when this happened. And so I have to disclose that I'm not very Christian-y.
Yeah.
And, you know, Christian-y is in kind of that cultural Christian-y.
Sure. Yeah.
Because it came pretty late. And so I don't, and I mean, I wasn't sort of admired in some of the cultural assumptions around how you respond to this and how you do this. And so,
yeah.
And I'm still not very Christian-y at all.
Yeah. So, but, you do have this, kind of, look at, the kind of spiritual ramifications of things and so forth that does seem, you know, for, I think, most people, but the caricature of kind of someone who's really interested in technology or thinking about where technology is going or something like that, that seems unusual.
I mean, in religious circles.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It is, and I think I'm not sure why.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's partly because the traditional vocabulary of the faiths is traditional, and it doesn't. Yeah. There's not a lot of words for robot in Hebrew.
Right.
You know, I mean, so it requires you know, stepping outside, and that's actually one of my interests. And so I did a little essay and a talk for the Q conference about the next 1,000 years of Christianity, and because I'm amazed that for one of the longest lived institutions on the planet, there's such a dearth of taking a long view of this institution on the planet in the next 1,000 years. And so there's basically one single scenario that the church has had for 2,000 years, and it's been wrong for 2,000 years.
Right.
It's the same scenario for 2,000 years, which is that the world's going to end tomorrow.
Right.
And it's been wrong for 2,000 years. So it's like, well, you would think at this point there'd be a second or third alternative. And just in case that first one is going to be wrong again, which is highly likely at this point.
Yeah.
And so if I give me again to think about, well, what's the 1,000-year scenario for Christianity? And for me, one of the most fundamental aspects of it is that the language would have to change.
Hmm.
If it's to be around in 1,000 years from now, when we have such if you look at what's happening in just the past 20 years, and we talk, you know, we extrapolate what's going to happen in the next 200 years, in the next, it's just, the language will just certainly have to shift.
Yeah.
And I use the word language in a broad sense of just the metaphors, the framing is, it can't, you know, if it exists in 1,000 years from now, it will have to be interpreted in a very different way than it is currently. And so my effort is to do that. And one of the ways I think that will propel this is with the arrival of AI in a very sophisticated kind, who will provoke in us. And the little assignment that I've given myself is to write a catechism for robots.
It's amazing.
Right. It's to say, when this AI says, I am a child of God, I want to have a book or a document, something to give to them and say, well, here's where you came from. Here's Here's how you fit into the cosmos. Here's how we fit. What's your relationship to Jesus? Mm-hmm. Right? Does Jesus cover you? You're not. You have no blood. What's?
Yeah.
You know. And I think having to talk to AI will require us to retranslate
mm-hmm.
in some ways. And to have a cosmic Jesus, really, basically.
So that's really interesting. So have you made any progress on this catechism yet?
It's very slow going. Partly because there's so many different ways it could go, and I've been talking about it for a couple of years, and every now and then someone will send me a suggestion. So the honest truth is that I haven't gotten very deep into it. And also, being honest, part of the reason is I don't have a whole bunch of answers. It is difficult to know what to say. I'm not a trained theologian, and so getting other theologians to kind of play with this has been in short supply. Yeah. I've identified a couple people whom are thinking about this. There was a guy from the Vatican who was actually trying to talk about would they baptize ET?
Yeah.
And but I haven't done the full. I haven't applied my full attention to it. Is the best answer.
Well, it's a very ambitious project, but I think that's you're right. That's such a great opportunity for focus and for thinking, and I think you've kind of hit on something, which is the language differential between, we have 2,000 years. Our source material is much older than that, but we have 2,000 years of this language built up to express things in certain ways, and in order to talk about things like AI or just any of the other kind of technological developments that have happened or are, going to happen in the near future, we have to do so much translation, and people on both sides of that are often very uncomfortable with that translation effort because it seems somehow inauthentic. But I think it's absolutely essential. We've been doing translation all along the way. Now we're just going to have to do it in a much shorter time frame.
Well, not just more, it's a much bigger jump. I mean, again,
yeah.
Like to use my example of, the kind of framing metaphor, and say in both the Old Testament and New Testament, is blood.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which doesn't have a lot of meaning for an AI.
Right.
And so, translating from blood to something else, that's a huge jump. That's just not a different word for blood. It's a different concept. I mean, yeah. And what is that concept and what's that thing? So this is a quantum jump. Translation is probably a too mild a word. It's almost even interpretation or something. But it's a significant. Significant. Step. So that, I think it fits into a little bit of the transhumanist trend in that sense of I think part of what AI is forcing us to do, and this little project is an example of it, is redefining who we are, what humans are about. What is a human? And there's a couple of things that are forcing us to that redefinition, and I think the prime one is AI and robots. Mm-hmm. And each year, each month, each day, each announcement of some advance in AI is forcing us to redefine who we are, and that's going to be ongoing and nonstop for the next century at least. Mm-hmm. And so even if we didn't do anything, even if we didn't do anything with our own humanity, just the progress of AI would cause us to redefine it. But we are also at the same time literally altering us, mm-hmm, genetically and cybernetically. And so we are also morphing at the same time that we're redefining ourselves. And so that's double the redefinition, double the rate, yeah, that we have to reimagine who we are. And that's another reason to write a new catechism.
Yeah. That's and I think, you know, for a lot of people see technology as being something that's foreign or alien, or it doesn't have a role, you know, it shouldn't have a role in our spirituality or our religion. But you've said in What Technology Wants and in other works, you've said technology is basically an extension of life.
Yes.
Technology
of life, not just humans, but of life itself. Yeah. Right.
So most people would find that a pretty hard thing to grasp initially. Yeah. How would you explain that?
Well, let me tell you the origin of there are many origins of thinking, but one way to think about it is, there's a very kind of at this point, pretty extensive literature thinking about the role of humans, God, and nature. Mm-hmm. So, like, what's the, and so there's this whole kind of stewardship, mm-hmm, theology about, okay, you know, what's our, are we to have dominion over nature, or are we to be stewards of nature, and what's the relationship between nature and God, you know, God having made nature. And so my question was, what's the relationship of God and technology? Mm. Okay. And, is technology just human making and it's sort of a derivative of humankind? So God has a relation with humans and no relationship to technology directly. It's only through us. Or is technology kind of like a parallel human thing or what? And so my conclusion after looking at the general dynamics of technology and how it works is that actually technology is a form of life that's, I would say, in the same way that we are a form of life, we humans. You know, we're living, we've evolved, we're a product of evolution. And so technology is that further evolution of that thing that life, that we have in common with life. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, therefore in some ways, the relationship of technology to the divine is that it's a reflection of the divine in the same way that nature is a reflection of the divine. Mm. And that would be sort of one way to say that. And therefore, that when we think of technology, I would say that its origins is not like in human minds, but the origins back at the Big Bang. I mean, it's the same self-organizing thing that God unleashed at the beginning of creation. And so the way that we think of technology is, I think then that makes it into a holy thing rather than a devilish thing. Mm-hmm. Because there is, I think, one kind of a strand which assumes that technology is kind of basically a evidence of the fall. It's kind of like it's sinful.
Right.
It's something that has to be, I don't know what you call it, more than redeemed, but in some ways that it's a product of sin in a certain sense. And I would reverse that entirely. Say no, it's actually a reflection of the divine.
Yeah. So, and you know, this kind of ties in another thing you've said is our job is to surprise God. And I kind of wonder about that in terms of thinking about, you know, what's inevitable versus what we can do. What is our role in that?
Well, I mean, it's not very much different from predestination and free will.
Yeah.
So, I do think that the two are combined, that you know, the large forms of the bigger shape, the large shape of history, the unfolding, is predetermined in a certain sense, is predetermined by the very nature of the structure of matter in the universe. So that my suspicion is that you know, there's been a lot of parallel convergence. They call it convergent evolution on this planet, which means that the things unfold very similar because they are constrained to some measure by the physics of, say, you know, how tall a tree can be, or how big can an organism be, or its heart rate, all dictated by the fact that these are they have to be made of atoms, and atoms have only so much room that they can move, and the very physics constrains what can be made. And so even on other planets, we're going to find similar things like bilateral symmetry or quadrupeds, other things that just make physical sense. And so within those large forms, a lot of the particulars will be completely unpredictable, completely contingent, and to use the word, on whatever accidental origins they may have. And so the actual particulars are unpredictable, and the particulars are often as important, or if not more important to us, than the general form. So I like to say that the internet was inevitable, but Twitter was not. And so the internet was inevitable, but the kind of internet, whether it's international, national, private, commercial, open or closed, those are choices that we have, and those choices make a huge difference. And as I said earlier, you didn't have much of a choice whether you were a teenager, but you had a lot of choice in what kind of teenager you were, and that is sufficient in some sense, or sufficient a job. You know, even if we don't get to choose whether we're a teenager, it's a big enough of a job to choose what kind of teenager we're going to be.
Yeah.
So I think there's still plenty of room for individual action.
Yeah.
And responsibility.
I like it. Well, I know your time is you've got a lot of things going on, so I'll go.
Let's
ahead.
Do one more question.
Yeah.
And maybe some other time we can continue the conversation. There's obviously a lot to say, but let's do one more question.
Okay. Well, let me think. There's so much. What haven't I asked that you think is important to communicate?
Well, one other I would put it almost maybe for your audience, a near heretical thought is that I believe that we humans have had a lot of responsibility for inventing ourselves. And this goes back to this mandate of what I think of, you know, the kind of my catechism for us, which is that our purpose, I believe, is to surprise God. So I think the vision that I have of God is a very big God who let the world evolve, who started it, and is making the world through evolution. And our role in that is to, I wouldn't call it complete, but is to mirror God. It's God is a creator, and we are the image of God, so we are creators as well. Mm-hmm. And that was the genius of saying, well, okay, I'm going to make this creation, but I'm going to make it by putting my creative spirit into this thing I'm making to give them the same kind of some of the stuff that I have. And instead of me making everything, I'm going to have these, I'm going to make something that will make something that I could have made, but they'll think of something different.
Yeah.
And this kind of way of extending his spark into the thing that he's making. And so he, in some ways, he's owning it in this, in the sense, by giving us free will, his free will. Mm-hmm. And that is, that's a huge thing. So what we are doing in a certain sense is what he was doing, which is creating something. And his joy is when we create things that are true, good, and beautiful. And that is why I think what we use, what we do with technology. And so and as we do that, we are also inventing ourselves. We're also creating ourselves. That's part of the process, that each time we do that, we develop into being more of a creator. So we are, in some senses, creating our own ability to create. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this, there are many levels of this, but I think I think that that's our measurement, and I think that also applies to us individually, not just as a species. But I think when we're born, it's like here's this yet another mix of talents, and it's like, okay, God's saying, okay, you're unique. Do something with that. Makes you know, realize what it is you have and come to its fruition. Show love in a new, unique way. Yeah. You know, share in a way that I may not have ever thought of, even if I had an eternity to think about. And so I think that surprise. By surprise, I mean we create. We create something that is creative in the sense that it did not exist except by us. And I think that's how I approach my life, which is can I do something true, good, and beautiful that only I could do. Mm-hmm. And I think if you can do that, then you have surprised God.
Wow. Yeah. I think, yeah, you're pulling out something that I think is so neglected. And that is the core of the Christian tradition. It's right at the very first chapter of the Bible. It's, you know, that we are created in the image of a creator, and
right.
God seeks to kind of partner with us.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that to me, you know, as we think about like kind of what our significance is, like we have to keep coming back to something like that, right? Like otherwise, what are we here for if it's just to do something that's already completely pre-planned?
Yeah, yeah, it doesn't make much sense, and personally, I think a person is defined by their concept of God. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm doing in now my more adult life is I'm interested in the biggest, most powerful God as possible.
Yeah.
And I think a god that could unleash this and would be brave enough to put his spark of free will into his creation is a much bigger god than other gods that I've come across, and including in the established religions, including within Christianity. So I think I think part of what, in kind of a curious way, part of what technology is doing is allowing us to have a bigger vision of God.
Hmm. Wow. All right. Well, thank you.
So we'll end there.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. I would love to, come back and explore all kinds of things that we could jump off from there. So,
I hope this is useful to you and your listeners. And thanks for taking time. The book is called The Inevitable. It's about the, as I said, the long-term trends. It doesn't get into any of this stuff that we talked about.
Yeah.
but the what technology wants talks about it, and indirectly.
Yeah.
But if you want to be more pragmatic about what I think we should expect from AI, from virtual reality, from more screens, from the internet, check out The Inevitable.
Definitely will. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, and I look forward very much to reading it. So thanks, Kevin, and
sure thing.
I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Hey, folks, Micah here. Thanks so much for listening. Remember to go to Christianity.plus. That's the web address, Christianity.plus, to subscribe via email or iTunes to the podcast and to see show notes and links for this episode. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.